Hi, I'm Dr. Julia Sigwart, and you're listening to Weird Species, an original podcast by Senckenberg. Here we tell stories about fascinating species from every corner of the world. It might be an animal or a plant. It might be tiny or large, super well-known or newly discovered. In each episode, I talk to an expert about their favorite species, and I always hear something I'd never heard of before. I'm very excited to welcome you all back to another episode of Weird Species and to introduce my guest today, Dr. Eken Tillage, who is the polyketologist of Senckenberg. He's our resident worm expert because every institution needs a worm expert. Welcome, Eken. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And so I know that you've listened to former episodes of Weird Species.
Yes, I did. Yes. So I'm a little prepared.
Good. In fact, I know you've listened to them because your students told me that you listened to them.
Yeah, I do teach a class on scientific communication, and you've been a frequent guest in that class, talking to students about how to do outreach and science communication.
So this goes out to your students, and on behalf of your students, I'm going to grill you a little bit.
Oh, no.
And so they can answer all these questions correctly on their exam. But we're going to talk a little bit about, I want to know about your journey and what brought you to Senckenberg and how you became a worm expert. And eventually we're going to work our way up to your favorite weird species. And since you work on worms, I'm sure you've got a weird one to tell us about. But let's talk for a little bit about where you came from. But I'm going to ask you a midpoint question first before I start the therapy session and ask you about your childhood trauma. I want to know, when did you get your first tattoo?
Oh, wow. I got my first tattoo during my PhD, probably, or right after, and it was a worm.
Okay.
Yeah.
How many worms do you have tattooed on your body?
I lost count at some point. I honestly don't know. I wouldn't be able to answer that without, like, counting.
Okay. No, that's okay. Please keep your clothes on, even though it's for audio only.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we don't have a video. That would make a fantastic...
Yeah, you know, let's not do that.
Get the clicks on the video. No. And how many tattoos do you have that are things other than invertebrates?
Not many. I do have some that are not invertebrates. I have a fly. I have some...
That's an invertebrate.
Oh, that's true. I was thinking of like marine invertebrates, sorry. But I do have my frogs.
Oh.
Yeah. So I'm wearing shorts for people who are just listening, and I'm showing Julia my leg.
And that reminds me of a story that you told me relatively recently when you had a photo shoot for Senckenberg.
Yes. So I was on this was a campaign, and a few of the scientists here at Senckenberg were kind of asked to be part of this campaign to be on the subway. So we have a Senckenberg subway driving around Frankfurt with a few scientists, and we had a photo shoot for that. And the photographer was like, saw that I had tattoos on my leg, and there were so many people, like there was a makeup person, there was people then like kind of adjusting our clothing and whatnot. And the guy was like, oh my God, I see tattoos. We need to see more leg. We need to see more tattoos. And so there is the photo that ended up on the subway has my pants are slightly like adjusted so that it looks like as if it naturally, as if I'm naturally showing off some tattoos, but that definitely was not very natural. So it was intentional. Yeah.
And just to explain to people who haven't seen it,
yeah.
When we say that we've got Senckenberg scientists on the subway, we mean there is a full wrap of the outside decoration of the entire train,
yeah.
Which is covered in giant photographs of Senckenberg scientists.
With our names on it and with little catchphrases. So mine says, Eken findet Würmer, which means like Eken finds worms. And there's a bunch of worms on the subway on my side. I mean, I love it. And people often send me photos of them when they see it. I don't see it that frequently, which is fine. I don't need to see myself on the subway every day. I'm actually glad that doesn't happen. But yeah, it is a bit odd, right? You don't really get to do that kind of stuff as a scientists that often.
No, it's been super fun. I got very excited when I saw it go through the station next to my apartment. I took a selfie with you and the others on the subway.
I'm on
your subway. Yeah, it's been great. Okay, so let's go back to where this strange obsession with worms came from. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Turkey, and I grew up, I always loved being in the ocean or in the Mediterranean, and honestly, like, worms, that's an acquired taste, I would say. Like, I will never say it's like it was love at first sight, but I was always into marine invertebrates. I did start scuba diving pretty young, and I was also always in the water. And my, like, first, the first thing that caught my attention was actually nudibranchs, so, which will be nice for you probably. Yeah, so I was always into mollusks mostly. So I started with nudibranchs, right? So I did my bachelor's and master's on nudibranchs. And nudibranchs, I think, are like the gateway invertebrates, right? They're like super pretty, super colorful, like the butterflies of the ocean. So they're easy to like, and their biology is super fascinating, like with all their weird defense mechanisms and whatnot. So I, that's how I got into invertebrates. And then after my master's, I was looking for different options to do a PhD. And then the worms was like a chance, I landed on worms by chance, and then I loved them ever since.
But you did most of your studies here in Germany.
So I did.
What age were you when you moved from Turkey?
I was about 17, so I came right after high school.
Oh, wow. And straight into undergraduate. And how was that?
Now that I look at it, it's probably, it was brave, I would say. Like, I was super young. I did, and so I must say, like, my mom is German. I always had family in Germany. I had a connection to Germany. I've been to a German high school, so I spoke German. So it wasn't like going to a completely strange country, but it still is a big difference in living alone for the first time when you're 17 in a different country. That did have challenges, and I think I kind of opened up and became like more confident during my master's. So the undergraduate part was probably quite challenging in terms of like social
adjustment.
Yeah.
And did you? But there's a huge Turkish community in Germany, so did you feel more connected to your mother's German family back in Germany, that side, or more into the Turkish community where? After you arrived.
A bit of both. I think that makes the adjustment in Germany, particularly for someone who speaks Turkish and is familiar with Turkish culture, much easier, because there are loads of, like, you're exposed to Turkish all the time.
You get the food.
You get the good food, and you get the Turkish supermarket, so you get the products that you're used to. But of course, having German family, and that also helped a lot, right? I spend lots of time, especially in the beginning, all my weekends and stuff, visiting my aunt, and so that I had like family and kind of a network that I could rely on.
Yeah. And sometimes that's nice because you have a soft place to land, but it also stops you from being really completely your own person when you move away.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah, that's why it took a while probably for me to kind of build my own network. And
yeah. Also, the difference between 17 and 21 is
huge.
Yes, a lot. Yes,
it's huge.
Okay, so then you started your PhD, and what happened then?
With my PhD, I was really, I think if there would have been funding, I would have probably stayed with nudibranchs if that would have been possible. But that was not an option. So I was looking into kind of different PhD options. And my PhD advisor had just moved to Bonn from Berlin. So I didn't know him that well, maybe from one class. And I asked him actually for like a recommendation letter to apply for a lab in the States, which then I didn't end up getting into, which was the lab that I ended up going to as a postdoc later. But my PhD advisor then was like, well, you know, I wrote you this letter, but you could also do your PhD with me. And that never occurred to me as an option. So that was fantastic. And then I had a conversation with him, and I always thought that he worked mostly on Nemertians. I didn't know back then that he also did other stuff. And that was kind of like, I don't want to work with Nemerdians, actually, which I now do. But I don't know. I was very naive, and I was always very driven by the aesthetics of things. And I liked, like, for example, I know this sounds super strange, but I had, and also kind of odd for a PhD or like a master's student back then to be say this to a professor, but I was like, I actually want to work with the worms that look like flowers or something like that. You know, I had that vision. I want to work with these worms, but I want pretty worms. I don't want the ugly worms. Now I'm not that picky. Actually, the weirder, the uglier they are, the better it is. But back then I had this like some kind of visual image that I wanted to work.
But you know, I think this is actually a really underappreciated part of biology, because we're all driven by, you know, the evolutionary questions, or, you know, like strange ecology, or, you know, some very, very important highbrow scientific question. But it's also really important to like the animals that you're working on.
Yeah. And like, I don't know, like for me, I've always been a very visual person, and my PhD was all on morphology, like on really detailed ultrastructure histology. And it was all about like getting these really pretty and complex images. And I love doing that, and I still do.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of these different techniques like histology, and they're sort of associated with some kind of unbeautiful, unaesthetic parts of science, like forensics and medicine and, you know, phlebotomy, blood screening. But actually, the images that we get when we look at cells and tissues and the stains that we use, these classical techniques that I know you use, they produce images that are really beautiful.
Yeah, they're like pieces of art. I mean, it's amazing. Mm.
There was a series of, images that was this. Were you talking about this to me? Somebody was recently complaining that their doctor had renovated the waiting room, and they previously had beautiful prints of histology slides on the wall in the waiting room. And then the doctor's office got renovated and all of the histology images got taken away.
No, it wasn't me, but that would annoy me too.
Yeah. So you wanted to work on something beautiful.
Yeah.
And first you thought it was the worms, and then you realized that it was the insides of the worms.
Exactly. Exactly. And I did a lot of ultrastructure, which means a lot of electron microscopy. So looking into really high magnification details of structures that are inside cells and the cells themselves. And this ended up being 3D models and drawings of things. And the kind of work that I do, whatever it is, even now with more genetic stuff, it always has for me personally, a huge visual component. So I love making figures. That's like one of my favorite things to do. So I will always start with the figures when I start writing a paper, and then the writing happens later.
Yeah, so you have, it's mostly about showing off the pretty pictures of your pretty worms.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, science can be that. I think that's fine.
Yeah, and you know, worms are not that easy to sell, but I think I've gotten good at it, but I've definitely kind of developed my little toolkit to make worms as attractive as possible.
Some of them are beautiful.
Yes, and most people don't know about them.
But the internet loves worms.
Do they?
Well, this seems to be a trend, because we do a lot of outreach, especially for marine invertebrates and the Senckenberg Ocean Species Alliance. And I don't know, maybe it's just because you're so famous, but we get so many clicks. You know, when there's posts about polychaetes, about marine worms, they get so much attention.
Oh, I love to hear that. Yeah, that's nice. I don't think it's me. I assume
it's
the worms.
Is it just you and all of your ghost accounts?
Yeah, it's all my, like, all my bots that I recruited. No, but it is, it's great to hear. I mean, I think people like, and that's why I love the name of this podcast, Weird Things, right? Like, the weirder the animals, the more unusual, alien-like they are, the more fascinating I think they are. Also for me personally, from a biological perspective. So, and I think worms have a lot to offer in terms of weird things.
Okay, so for we've gone a long time actually without really getting into some descriptions of worms. So everybody knows what a worm is, but I think most people have this mental image of just, you know, like the earthworms, the night crawlers that come out in the rain and, you know, kamikaze themselves onto the sidewalk for, you know, whatever ill the ground has done to them. But what kind of worms do you have? Like, what's your mental image of a worm?
Yeah, so I think one needs to probably emphasize that a worm is not like a natural grouping. It's like the body shape that evolved many, many times in all sorts of lineages. There are worm-like mollusks, there are so many animal phyla that we call worms that are not necessarily forming a monophyletic, we would call, like a, they don't come from a single evolutionary lineage. And the worms that I like the most, I would say, are the segmented worms, polychaetes, the ones that have these bristles and crazy body shapes, right? I talked about the worms that look like flowers. So that's a family that live in tubes that have a feathery crown that they stick out of the tube. So when you look at it, you would see them diving, or in underwater footage, you would see these animals that look like literally like flowers, and then they can retract to their tubes super rapidly. And as until you take them out of the tube, you don't actually see the wormy bits. So that is, there's a lot of diversity and body forms and shapes in what we call worms. So, and here in the museum, I'm responsible basically for the collection of polychaetes. That's the largest collection I'm responsible for. But in my section, I think you were the one who called me like the curator of everything else, which I think is true. I don't know if we can... I think this would be true. I think I have the largest number of phyla, maybe even collections in my section. I have 13 collections. And these are all things that traditionally were lumped into like vermes, like everything that looks like a worm, but there are like many, many different phyla, right? We have flatworms, we have ribbon worms, we have the nematodes and...
Sea cucumbers.
Yeah, well, I also have all the echinoderms, true.
Then all of these things are not related to each other. They all came to their wormness through different independent pathways. Yeah, so
being a worm must be quite advantageous, I guess.
What's the great thing about being a worm?
Oh, that's a good question. What's the great thing about being a worm?
I mean, if so many different animal groups have worm members, as you say, there must be some... pretty strong advantages, some great benefits to being a worm.
Yeah. I'd have to think about that. Okay. Do you know what's good about being a worm?
I don't know. You can fit in small spaces.
Sure.
Yeah. That's my favorite. goes down easy when somebody swallows you.
Yeah, I don't think that's an advantage.
That seems like a disadvantage.
Yeah.
Early birds can get one.
Yeah, great.
None of these things are good.
Yeah.
So then you talked about the worms that look like flowers. You haven't talked about the worms that are on fire. Those are also a fantastic group of worms.
Fireworms? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like fireworms. So they're also polychaetes, like bristle worms, and they have calcified bristles. So their bristles are extremely brittle. And you will see them when you're diving, and they're quite colorful. So it's very tempting to touch them. But you probably shouldn't, because they will burn you, because they actually have some really toxic chemicals that they secrete, and all of their brittle bristles are covered with this, so when the bristles break, they can cause little injuries. And it's an amazing defense strategy for the worms. And they're super colorful and brightly, but it's a warning color, right? It's not...
Seems mean. So you mentioned the ones that look like flowers and all of these beautiful colors. Why are there colors? So they're warning colors, or do they have other reasons for being so colorful? You collect them?
There can be different reasons. So in case of the fireworms that we just talked about that have these bright red kind of warning colors, that's probably to warn off predators. But then there are also other worms that have structural coloration, for example, in their skin, in their cuticle. And we have these beautifully iridescent scale worms, for example, that are described from 3,000 meters. They're called Elvis worms, I think is the common name. And because of their scales that look like the, what is it called in English?
Like the costume from the costume, Elvis, the yes, sequins.
Exactly, sequins. And that's the word I was looking for. So they have these really beautiful iridescent colors, but that's more of a side product of their cuticle. So that does not necessarily have a function because down there where they live, there is no light.
That's not an answer.
Wasn't the question why they have different colors?
Yeah, you've just told me why that they don't need the colors.
that particular example doesn't need a color. The other one is to warn off like predators.
Okay. Do you think that's a main reason?
For the bright color ones, mm-hmm. I would say so, yeah.
Okay. I mean, some of them are so spectacular, especially, you know, some of the fan worms, the cebellids, you know, these, as you said, like these flowery ones that stick out of their tube or their hole, and they're blue or they're red or they're yellow, or and they're not poisonous.
No, that's true. I think they're not attracting each other, that's for sure. Yeah. So it's not for getting mates. And there is so little known about like vision in these animals, but they don't see. I think that's mostly for predators and for.
One other thing that kind of comes into my mind is that in these shallow water marine environments, like as you said, where you would be scuba diving, whether it's in the tropics or even in higher latitude around, you know, cold water coasts, the marine environment is very colorful. We have seaweeds in all different colors, and you have encrusting sponges and small corals and things that are in all different colors. And actually, so having one group of animals that comes in different colors, especially if they can't see well, they still match the background because the background is super colorful.
And that is also for many of the other worms that I can think of that are super colorful, like hiding, camouflage is one of the reasons, right? So we have worms that live on sponges that would have the same color as the sponge. Or mysostomes, for example, that's a group of worms that live on crinoids, sea lilies, so a group of echinoderms, and they can have the stripes to match the stripes of the echinoderm that live on, or scale worms that live on sea cucumbers will match the color of the sea cucumber. So this kind of mimicry or camouflage is also a reason to have these strange color patterns, yeah.
And so you talked about scale worms, but I think that probably needs a little bit more explanation. So you're talking about something that's technically a worm.
Yes.
But it kind of looks like a bug. No offense.
Yeah, okay, well, that is a bit offensive for a worm person. But yeah, no, I think I get what you're saying, because their backside, so the dorsal side of the animal, so that is covered by the scale. So you don't necessarily see the wormy body, but the scales that kind of hide it.
It's like covered in, as you said, sequins. So like they've got two big rows usually of sequins.
Yes.
Going down the back. Yeah. Yeah. They just look like ribbons, but they're not called ribbon worms. It's all very confusing.
Yeah, it is confusing.
And you talked about one that lives at 3,000 meters, but you've been there.
Yes, I have. I've been lucky enough to be in as part of deep sea expeditions and go in submersibles, yeah. And these deep sea worms, the Elvis worms, I was actually there when we collected them. That was with an ROV, so with a remotely operated vehicle. It's like a robot that you control from the ship. And we collected these beautiful scale worms and filmed them. So yeah, and it was amazing to see these animals live in their natural habitat and watch them do weird things and observe their behavior.
So what does that feel like when you finally get to see these things that you knew about, you've read about them, but you've never seen them alive, and you're in this really remote place?
I love doing field work. I think that is kind of like why, probably, I don't know, that applies to you too, probably, right? Seeing these animals live is always different than seeing things that are preserved. You could sit me in front of a microscope, give me a dish of like some washed algae or like some sediment, and I can sort through that for hours. And that is so calming and meditative. And I know it sounds very nerdy and odd to most people probably, but that would be my guilty pleasure. Like put me in front of a microscope. And I mean, I do this on holidays, right? So I go to Turkey quite often every year in the summer. My parents have a summer house. I have my microscope there. I'll get a dish from the kitchen, collect some algae, and then look through that. And it's relaxing. That's vacation for me, where I don't have to respond to emails, but look at like weird critters.
But I think that's a funny thing when we talk to people who are not biologists about the idea of field work, you know, like the idea of like I'm on a ship, I'm going on a deep sea expedition, or I'm going to the coast, I'm gonna get on my scuba gear, like all of that is like, okay, I have an image in my mind of like what this might be like. But the fact that we still spend 99% of our time on field work actually looking down a microscope, you know, and you're looking at a dish full of you know, collected sediment or small things, or like trying to identify samples or you know, identify them or prepare them, rather than the actual, you know, trekking out into the wild. That's like 1% of the time.
And I think there is a lot of the like scientific training. I learned so much on field trips, and not necessarily like as a student too, but also on field trips that I've been to, maybe as a postdoc or with my mentors, because that's when you kind of, there are so many things that it's so hard to teach from a book. Like a lot of polychaetes families, I can identify by their movement. Because you kind of develop a feeling for it, right? So you see, or like this animal crawls a certain way, so it's more likely to be this or that. So, and this, I think you can only teach and learn if you kind of have that visual and that experience.
And
So,
you have someone else to
show
help point
you
it out to you.
exactly.
So speaking of extremely, extremely small worms, I want to
Yes.
get on to making you pick one species. And I want you to think of the smallest species that you can, because I already know what your favorite species is. Tell me about one weird species.
Yeah, so I thought about this quite a bit, and I think the one that I want to talk about is a very small one, as you said. It's not necessarily the one that I often spend time talking about, because there are other worms that people like to like to hear me talk about. But this one is actually very interesting because it's So, okay, I'll start off with saying what it is. It's the so-called Charlie Chaplin worm, and the Latin name is Histriopsis homari. These worms live on lobsters as commensals or ectosymbionts. So this all means basically they're kind of tiny little worms that are not necessarily parasitic, so they don't harm the lobster. The idea is that they kind of help clean the lobster. So they live on the lobster's gills, on their eggs, and they're extremely, extremely small. And I've worked on them on and off, and we just did a big project here where we sequenced the genome of the Charlie Chaplin worm, and I just love them. And the reason is they are extremely cute. They are super small, and they have these two little feet-like appendages on their posterior end that they walk on.
I thought you said they were worms.
Yeah, that's why they're called Charlie Chaplin worms, because they walk like Charlie Chaplin. And I.
With the trousers down around his ankles.
Yes. Have you ever seen one?
Yes, I remember when you had them in the lab.
So, but yeah, so they're amazing. And then they. What makes them so cool is they still have really complex jaws that resembles the jaws of a polychaete group that we know more about. And so this kind of gives us an idea where they belong to in terms of like their evolutionary lineage. But genetically, they've been extremely hard to place in that group because they're so weird. So this is actually one of those cases where we know where it should go,
From the jaws.
From the
And that's
jaws.
important for worms.
In this case, it is because they have a very characteristic jaw apparatus that matches what that larger group has.
But you have a combination of like a very weird body that's not like anybody
Anything
else at
else?
all, and you've got the mouth of one group, and then but that feels like it's kind of not enough to go on because they're so weird.
Yes, but the mouth parts are so specific that we know it should probably go somewhere near that group we know more about. But genetically, it has been impossible to put them in there because they have these really strange, I think their genome is also quite strange because they are weird. And so now with the maybe more data that we generate and with more stuff, we will be able to do that. But this is a good example because we can actually test the hypothesis, right? In other groups where we have similar issues, we don't have the morphological cues, so we don't even know where they should go. And in this case, we actually have a hypothesis where we can what we can test with the
So
data
that's
that.
not just about placing this one worm in one family, who's related to whom. It's also about, we think that this very specific kind of jaw means something, that it only evolved once, and now you
We can
think we
test
can.
that idea.
But have you answered it yet?
No, not yet. I'm
Well,
working on it.
come on. So why is it your favorite already?
It's my favorite because I think it's just so weird. I love that the fact that they're weird. I love
They
the fact
walk.
that they walk. I love that they live on lobsters. I mean, how cool is that?
I mean, I remember seeing them when you had them in the lab because the only way that you could collect them was literally by going and buying live lobsters.
Yes, and I've done this in multiple places in different institutions I worked at here, but also when I was a postdoc in the US. And yeah, you can imagine how hard it is to get that reimbursement, right? So how do you explain why you're ordering all these like live lobsters and then having lobster dinners?
It was good, actually.
Yeah, we ate
We
it.
ate it.
Yeah,
Yeah.
see?
You catered the department meeting, the department party afterward. It was very good timing.
Yeah, so it should be your favorite worm too.
I like the host organism a lot. And how do you find them? So you said that they're tiny, they're microscopic. They're so small that you can't see them with the naked eye on the lobsters, and they're like kind of hanging out in the gills of the lobsters. So do you have to like flip over a live lobster and, argue with it about cleaning its gills, or what do you do?
Yeah, so unfortunately, the lobster does not survive the process, but we've kind of cleared that, right?
You had a plan.
We had a plan. But you need to look at the gills of the lobster under a microscope.
So you
And
can't just do this in a seafood restaurant.
I mean, you need a microscope. You could take your microscope to a seafood restaurant, but that would be probably not welcome.
And then you try to explain to the waiter, why do you have a microscope at your table?
Yes.
Well, we're looking for worms. What? No, but they're really interesting worms.
Yeah, but like in order to give people an idea of the size, they're like less than definitely maybe 0.5 millimeter long, super small, but they are super abundant. So a lobster sometimes can have hundreds of them, right? 300, 400 of them on just one lobster. And you have all sorts of life stages of the worm living on the lobster, like babies, juveniles, and males and females. So I think I ordered two lobsters when I got like loads and loads of the worms and everything I needed for sure.
And do they spend their whole life on one lobster?
Yes.
And they just go where the lobster wants to go, and their babies grow up on the same lobster.
Yes.
But lobsters live a long time,
Yeah.
but not forever.
No. So they probably. I mean, I don't know how long the worms live, so we don't know that, but they probably live shorter than the lobster. And there seems to be lots of generations of worms on the lobster. And the lobsters kind of get near each other all the time. So they can probably hop off from one lobster to another if they need to.
Slightly mobile.
Yeah.
But it's a lot of like very detailed picking through the.
Yeah, and that brings us back to me sorting through things with a microscope. It's like whether it's lobster gills that I'm looking at or like some sort of sediment or marine trash, it's always I look for the movement. I see the little Charlie Chaplin worms crawling and dancing, and I pick them up with little pipettes.
I think that's fantastic. And I like that, we can just keep that in mind, right? In
Yeah, so when you're eating
any seafood
lobster
market.
next time, when you get like seafood, you should know that you're also probably eating some Charlie Chaplin worms.
I also want to ask you, maybe this is where we can end, but I want to tell you about a psychological experiment that I heard about quite recently. And it made me think about my own work and that of many of our colleagues, which is that there's a lot of interest in boredom. This is a whole trend on the internet now with people saying, that we should seek out boredom because we're constantly stimulated because we listen to podcasts or we're scrolling on Instagram. And so we should, digital detox, set it aside, learn to be still and be quiet. But there's a lot of psychological research about boredom. But some of the experiments I think are really funny and we would fail them. So one is there's a test for how people react to boredom. You have to make them bored. And so one of the tests is that you take a big bowl of beads or beans, some, small things
Oh, I'd
in
love
multiple
that. And then you
colors,
sort
and
them.
you have to sort them.
That's just this is like my dream.
Right? And there's rules. You can't like scoop them. You have to use one hand and sort them individually, one by one, into the different colors or the different categories. And this is supposed to be a task that's so boring, it makes people go crazy.
That would be my dream. I think this is like a lot of what we do in as taxonomists, as people working in museums. It's right. It's exactly that, right? I mean, I love sorting things. Yeah. Give me beads to sort.
Okay. So even in a world without podcasts, you're going to be okay.
I would probably listen to a podcast while I'm sorting beads.
No, no, no. It's cheating. But luckily, when you're actually working, you can do things the way that you want. So thank you so much, Ike Antelic, for joining us and sharing your love of worms and your love of sorting and all of the beautiful ways that these crazy animals can manifest.
Thank you. This was fun.